the part that is usually discarded would provide, depending on your caloric needs, right? Depending, if calculated to an athlete, we took 13 to 31 days worth of calories. That's the part we get rid of.
And it's the more nutrient dense
Yes.
part because you're including all the organ meats there and the marrows and
It's not only
brain.
nutrient more nutrient dense, it's more nutrient accessible as well. You don't even have to cook those parts to get all the nutrients out of
Welcome to the Fat Emperor podcast. I'm your host, Ivor Cummins. We have a visitor to Ireland today, and that's Bill Schindler, who's director of the Eastern Shore Food Lab and associate professor of archaeology.
Absolutely. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here, actually, and I'm glad now you let me know a couple of weeks ago you were swinging by Ireland.
Quick visit.
Yeah, very good. Well, you know what? A lot of people might be familiar with you, but it'd be good to start just going through the modern Stone Age diet, because that's kind of your thing.
Sure.
And maybe describing what that is or what it's about or where it came from.
Yes. So I've always been interested in food. In my background, I was a overweight, pudgy, awkward kid. Bad relationship with food as a kid. I remember, you know, my body image was linked to how I ate, and I knew, you know, every time I put food in my mouth, I had this again strange connection, and made me feel ugly, made me feel like somebody was picking on me, made me get beat up. So I still remember even walking past every window, anything that had a reflective surface, I would gaze in it and look and suck my stomach in and feel bad and do it in the next one and the next one. And this went on for many years, but at the same time, my father had me hunting and fishing and trapping and outside quite a bit. So it was, again, a really weird relationship. And then I became a college athlete, Division I athlete for Ohio State. I was a wrestler in one of the best programs in the country, and I lost a ton of weight. I mean, at that point, I was already an athlete, so I had trimmed down. I didn't have this negative body image, but had a weirder relationship with food, because, you know, wrestling and the relationship with food is a very, very strange one, especially then. Cutting weight, sucking down weight. I was losing 21 pounds every week and a day and a half to make weight.
20 pounds a week?
20 pounds, 21 pounds. From Wednesday to Friday, I would lose that amount of weight. And again, everything was still strange in my head, because I looked better, I was in shape, but I didn't feel right. I had gone to nutritionists, I had, you know, team doctors, all these people telling me how to eat what they thought at the time is very high carbohydrate, low fat diet. I like to say I performed well despite my diet, not because of it. And then when I left, after I graduated, or after I left, I put weight back on very rapidly and experienced all sorts of gastrointestinal issues. You know, my wife and I would go out to dinner, and I would look for the bathrooms on the way there, because I knew I couldn't make it home after I ate. All sorts of issues. So I had this very weird relationship with food for a very long time, and had always been asking this question: what should I eat? And to answer that question, I first turned to archaeology. Right. So I thought I need to ground this in an understanding of our dietary past. So at the time when I started, I thought it would be very interesting to know how we've eaten for hundreds and thousands of years. But as I learned more, I realized I needed to know how we've eaten for hundreds of thousands of years or millions of years, and what the diet was that actually built us as a species biologically and culturally. So that was great, and I'm still involved with that, but that really helped inform my baseline for what I think a proper human diet should be to feed us biologically. And, you know, we as Homo sapiens appear on this earth 300,000 years ago, and biologically the way we deal with food really hasn't changed. So I use that as a baseline. After I realized that was so important to understanding and creating that baseline, I figured, you know what, I need to understand, there's so many holes in the archaeological record. We know people were doing something like this, or they might have been approaching food in this way, but there's a lot of gaps. So I put on my anthropology hat and started to work with people around the world, indigenous and traditional groups that are still engaged in a lot of these food processing strategies, to sort of see it in action, right? And see how it worked, not only in their kitchens or around their hearths, but also in their families and in their communities. And that was mind-blowing. And I've been doing most of that for about 10 years now. And then about 5 years ago, I was on a television program called The Great Human Race for National Geographic. And it was a 10-episode series where they took me and my co-star, Kat Bigney, and they put us in 10 different locations around the world. We started in Tanzania, ended in Oregon. And each episode was a different place and a different time period in our evolutionary past where something important happened. We developed some kind of a technology that really changed the game for us in some way. And it was my job to replicate the technologies from that time period. And we both were supposed to live for a period of about 8 days at a time using only those technologies. So we started at 2.5 million years ago and went through time up until 4,000 years ago, again in Oregon, and up through Africa, across the Middle East, into Asia, and finally into America. And that was mind-blowing because it was I've been doing this research for a long time. I've been teaching about it for a long time and speaking about it for a long time, but I actually got to feel it. Right? We're the only two people ever in the history of the planet to have experienced all the major time periods of our evolutionary past. And 8 days is not that long, but it's long enough to be hungry, it's long enough to be scared, it's long enough to start to feel what a diet might have felt like. And I was convinced after that that there's something to this. Like, this isn't necessarily a paleo diet approach, but there's something in the past that really holds the key for us understanding where to move forward. So the final piece of the puzzle was I realized that, you know, I have this archaeological perspective, I have this anthropological perspective, I have this sort of hands-on perspective, but I need, if any of this is going to work, right, if any of it's going to actually take off and take hold in modern Western society, it has to meet more than just our biological needs. It has to meet our cultural needs as well, because food is so intricate to what we are as humans. So it has to meet or exceed our expectations of taste and flavor. It needs to be accessible and meaningful and relevant. So even though I've been in the kitchen my whole life, I realized that I needed to be a little bit more professionally trained. So I started to train at the Italian Culinary Institute in the School of Artisan Food in England, and I worked with cheesemakers in different parts of the world. And I tried to learn these techniques in an industrial kitchen setting to be able to bring that to it as well. So this modern Stone Age diet approach is taking the archaeology and the anthropology and the modern food system and fusing it all together to make our approach to food meaningful, accessible, and relevant. And that was a long-winded answer, wasn't it?
No, that's an excellent summary, Bill, to be honest. And really, in terms of paleo, the paleo guys tend to say, oh, no dairy, just because in timeline that wasn't there. Sure. But I think you'd probably believe that dairy, if properly prepared and the proper methods, it can be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is my take on it. And this is where I stand hard. The human body, humans are one of the weakest species on the planet, and we have an incredibly difficult time getting food. We always have. And, you know, the example I always give is, I don't care if you knew all the edible plants, you knew all the behavior patterns of animals around the world, if I stripped you down naked and put you anywhere in the world with no tools at all, you would die of starvation. You could not fuel your bodies with just our nails and our muscles and our teeth. We just can't access the nutrients we need from our environment. So that's kind of interesting. So we've invented technologies and approaches to access food from the environment. But more importantly, and what's even more powerful when you think about food, and this is where my approach stems from, our digestive tracts are one of the weakest and most inefficient of most animals on the planet. So it's half the size that it should be for a similar sized primate. Our teeth have gotten smaller over time. So anything that we have going for us, even if we can get resources, we can't really do a whole lot with them. You know, we were talking earlier about Stephen Gundry. Stephen Gundry wrote in his book, I think it's a great analogy, you know, we have this idea that if you look at a box or a can of food and it's got the nutrition label on the side, it says this, this many calories, protein, fat, that if you eat that, all of that magically goes everywhere it needs to go in your body, just because you put it in your mouth. And he said, no, just because the only thing you know when you put in, that you can be confident of when you put food into your mouth, is that it's going to come out the other end at some point. It's a tunnel. Our digestive tract is a tunnel with an entrance and an exit. So food has to be in the right state. We have to be in the right state in order to take the nutrients from the food that we're eating and safely and effectively put it where it needs to go in our bodies. So when we start accessing these resources from our environment that we're not built to access, we also need to invent or create technologies that allow the nutrients in them to become accessible to our bodies. Other animals have these things naturally, like a cow has a fermentation chamber. So it can eat grass and support these huge bodies, right? Because of fermentation. Well, we don't have that, right? So we could eat grass and we would die of starvation next to a huge cow that's maintaining it. ducks and geese have different things in their digestive systems that allow them to safely and effectively transform a grain like barley into nutrients into their bodies. But they have something called a crop, right? Which when a duck takes in a grain, it swallows it and it goes into a pouch. And it's an enlarged, muscular, moist pouch where these grains sit sometimes 12, 14, 16 hours. And during that time, they soak, they ferment, and sometimes even start to sprout. And then once that's done, they swallow. It goes further down. It goes into a gizzard, which are two muscular discs. And they swallow all these rocks and this grit and the sand that sits in between them. And these discs go like this, and it grinds these softened, soaked, fermented grains. And then it goes into the rest of their digestive tract. And the rest of their digestive tract operates very similar to ours. So when we eat grains, we don't have a crop. We don't have a gizzard. We as humans, what we do is create technologies to process food outside of our bodies before it goes into our mouths. So in the case of grains, what a duck or a goose is essentially doing is, other than the baking part of it, they're making sourdough bread. I mean, they're literally, so in Ireland, for example, and I first noticed this because we were doing a workshop up in Mayo, County Mayo, at right near Cadia Fields. We were working with cornstones, which are, you know, these rotary stones. A duck and a goose, what they have in them, birds in general, have these. And they're also doing the fermentation inside of their bodies. And when I started thinking about that, I'm like, wow, that's fantastic. These animals have, biologically, are adapted to their wild, to the diets they're supposed to be eating. And we're not. I mean, we actually outgrew, we started to outgrow our digestive tracts 3.5 million years ago when we created our first tool that allowed us to process food before we ate it. So what do we, what is, how does that, where does that leave us? What do we do? We are actually eating foods we have no business eating, but at the same time, our bodies have been built over millions of years on the nutrients from those foods. We require them in our bodies. Now, I don't necessarily mean bread and milk for this, but I do mean, you know, different types of vegetables, different types of animals and animal parts. So we create these technologies.
And if you just go back a little then, so we have certainly created, I know, agrarian revolution, but even long before that, crushing the grains, heating them, humans found out how to detoxify grains and make them a simple, cheap kind of source of energy. But if you go way back hundreds of thousands of years ago, where would grains really have fit back then, or what would we mainly have eaten? Because are they not relatively recent grains?
So I got off track. So my point very quickly was that we started creating these technologies a long time ago to access nutrients from our environment and make those nutrients safe, nutrient dense, and bioavailable for our bodies. That's what almost every prehistoric technology had to do.
And would the earliest would have been, I guess, tools to smash bones and get marrow and all that. They would have been very early in evolution.
And 3.5 million years.
Yeah, and then grains and that and processing those way later.
10 to 15,000
years
ago. Extensively different. So but that process, the point I was trying to make was that process begins of creating technology, and simple technologies, but powerful technologies that allow us to overcome these physical limitations and access these nutrients, right, from the environment and put them in that safe, nutrient-dense, bioavailable state, begins with stone tools 3.5 million years ago. And then it moves to fire 2 million years ago, and hunting 2 million years ago, and fermentation technology, and all those sorts of things, cooking, and it goes on over time. And the point I was trying to make is, yes, the agricultural revolution of 10 to 15,000 years ago, which brings in grains and dairy, there's lots of bad things that happen as a result of that, but our human approach to food and taking these resources and making them safe, nutrient dense, and bioavailable didn't stop. We still found ways to do that with grains. We still found ways to do that with dairy. The problem is they've stopped now. Right, we process food now at the expense of the nutrients. We process food. We have these resources, whether they're animal or plant resources. We process them now for shelf life or for uniformity or for the way that they look or the way that they taste, and often at the expense of the nutrients.
And we've introduced as well ultra refining, really, to powder form, which arguably makes those grains much worse. And of course, the vegetable oils. We brought in these high temperature pressure hexane solvent extracted oils from seeds, which we never would have really had access to.
Sure.
So we've kind of spiked our food system with a lot of questionable stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about fat, you know, marrow, the earliest example of eating marrow dates to 3.4 million years ago. So we know that our ancestors, it was Australopithecus afarensis or Africanus, we're not sure which one, we know in Ethiopia, they were not only butchering scavenged animals, because we have the butchering marks on the bones of several different species, but they were also intentionally crushing those bones to access the marrow. And the cool thing about marrow, and anybody who suggests that animals near the equator, you know, have a lot less fat than the ones that are towards the poles, which is true, but not for marrow. An animal will starve to death before it depletes its marrow resources. So marrow is always there.
Right? And brain, I guess, and organ meats always tend to maintain a high fat and nutrient density. Yeah.
And the really cool thing is when you look at our dietary path through time, you know, we start before any tools, the only thing, and again, just think about yourself half the size out in the middle of nowhere trying to feed yourself with, you know, what you can get with your fingers and your little teeth. And it's a little bit of limited fruits, a little bit of limited vegetables, and some insects. I mean, that's what our diets were, right? And very seasonal, no food processing, no storage, none of that. So we stayed small. Our nutritional requirements were very low because our bodies were small and our brains were small. When we start introducing flesh, meat, into our diets, which is 3.5 million years ago, we don't see a huge jump in body or brain size. It's very interesting because you think, oh my gosh, we have animal resources now, all of a sudden we jump in size, but we don't. A little bit, but not much. The jump doesn't happen until 2 million years ago when we start hunting. And the difference is when we're scavenging, we're just introducing flesh and a little bit of marrow. Because the predator that killed the animal we're scavenging off of already took all the good stuff, right? It took the organs, it took the fat, it took the blood. But when we start hunting, we have first access and our bodies literally overnight jump in size to almost modern proportions.
Right, and it's sometimes suggested as well that fire and cooking released more energy from carbohydrate-based foods, but it doesn't, in the overall evidence base, what you said makes much more sense. Yeah. Mike Eads, Dr. Mike Eads, once said to me that the vast majority, if not nearly all, of the paleoanthropologists who are expert in this acknowledge what you said is the way it is. Are there any that would try and say it isn't so? Do you think?
I think in some of the earlier literature, when some of this evidence was being interpreted in a context, you know, remember the interpretation has as much to do with the interpreter as it does the evidence, right? So the people that were doing the interpreting were doing it within a context, you know, especially we're talking about the 70s here, a lot of this, you know, margarine's in now and, you know, carbohydrates are going to save the world, low-fat diets, all this. And how could you, within that context, if that was really how you were brought up and what you really believe, even consider diets that were building you had something else in them than what you were feeding your own children and your wife and your husband, right? So then I think the literature was a little bit different. Now most people would agree.
So it's reverted back to what kind of obviously makes sense. And we probably won't get into it here, but Dr. Eads did a huge amount of research and blogs on the nitrogen and carbon isotopes and how it essentially proves we were of that nature by themselves. So if you put it all together, I love the thing about animals are designed for their diets, really. And I remember hearing a couple of amazing examples. I think is it the koala that only eats certain leaves from a certain plant? I think
it could be, I don't know, but
I think it is. They only, and then giraffes, I think, very specific leaves from certain plants, and they literally will not thrive if you give them other stuff. So they're probably extreme examples. But what about our teeth? Teeth often come up as this, oh, vegetarian, vegan people will say we're herbivores via our teeth. Then carnivore type leaning people will say, oh no, we're carnivore. Well, what about the teeth?
That's a great question. So, and I'm glad we got to front load this with what I had said earlier. We are not designed to eat almost every food we put into our body. And that's very important to think about. So the question, are we designed to eat this food, is an irrelevant question. And it started becoming irrelevant 3.5 million years ago when we made our first stone tool. Right, we overcome our. So, are we designed to hunt animals? You know, jump on animals in the African savanna, rip them apart with our teeth? Absolutely not. Mm-hmm. We haven't needed to for 3.5 million years. Are we designed to plant grains in the ground and run them over without a plow and pull them out and grind them up and bake them and all this. Without, no, we do all of those things outside of our bodies as well. What we as humans do is overcome all of these limitations through creating technologies. So as far as teeth are concerned, we started accessing animals as soon as we created a tool. We've had animal flesh and marrow in our diets for 3.5 million years. We've had the entire animal in our diet for 2 million years. And for that entire time, and from that time forward, we have been evolving into these bodies with those resources coming in. But the important part of that conversation is what happens between the resource and our mouths, what we do to those foods.
The technology. And that's where humans are essentially unique.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the teeth thing, we inherited our teeth from our ancient ancestors and the ape family and all that. So they largely are similar to those guys. And I think the logic would say, as we access these new tools and sources, the teeth didn't have to evolve to be carnivore because we'd already bypassed being real hunting carnivores.
Absolutely.
So the teeth are just what they are.
In fact, our teeth are getting... So our brains over time, for 3.5, are exponentially growing, right? Huge. With these incredible nutrient, you know, needs that are growing with it as well. Our bodies are growing as well as through time. Our nutritional needs are skyrocketing, but our teeth are actually getting smaller over time. Our teeth are smaller now than they were in our 3.5-foot-tall ancestors. It just really speaks to the power of those technologies. We don't need those things. I mean, we need teeth, but we don't need teeth to do the bulk of the work.
Yeah, and by extension backwards, if you go back to the chimps and all, they got scary looking mouths, you know, they got the, because they really need those teeth to be the tools.
Yeah,
because they don't have tools. So it all dovetails together perfectly, and actually it's just so logical, really. It's kind of it's self-evident when you think about it and when you discuss it. So then the ideal diet, I work on behalf of Irish Heart Disease Awareness, yeah, as I was explaining earlier, and I'm going to have a focus this year on highlighting more and more the tofi, the thin outside, fat inside people, who we all know that the big, large fat person has high heart disease risk, or smokers. But people don't realize there's millions of apparently slim people with visceral fat inside, which is a modern epidemic. So what would that person who's tofi with visceral fat and inflammation, what would be an ideal ancestral diet for them? Just in a rough summary, the safest diet you can think of.
That's a great question. So it's such a great point, because we have this, and we've been battling obesity for so long that we have this image that slimness equals health.
Yeah.
And it's just because it's a thing we can see and put our finger on very easily, right? It's such a good point. What I like to do is I like to focus on how we eat and not what we eat. Right. So we have humans have populated the world, tons of different resources, different environments. And the one thing that we've held in common out of all of those is that we have always in the past approached whatever resource we're using as our resource base in a way that we've made it the safest, most nutrient dense bioavailable as possible. Period. That's what we do. So when I feed my family, or I talk to my students or people that are working with me, and we sit down and look at what they're eating, the first thing that I do, well, the first thing I do is get rid of all nut and seed oils. But other than that, that's the first thing. The second thing that, because, you know, animal fats have been in our diet for millions of years. Nut and seed oils, what, 125 years max? I mean,
approximately.
Something like that. That's a brand new thing in our evolutionary past. But no matter what it is that's in their diet, the next step that I go through with them is, what are you doing to those foods? Because the end result, if you take this path or this path, are completely different foods. So a loaf of sliced pan and a loaf of long fermented sourdough bread, we call those things bread. But they're two completely different foods. Our bodies don't look at the labels. Our bodies deal with them in a completely different way. And the bread is a great example, because that long, slow fermented sourdough bread is essentially what's happening inside the natural anatomy of things like ducks and geese. And I just read an article the other day about angel wing disease in ducks and geese that live in parks. And what happens is, when you're feeding them bread, sliced pan, you know, the old people sit on the bench and feed the ducks or whatever, we think it's a wonderful thing, they're actually getting malnourished. and they see, and you can see it, something gets deformed in their wings. And so think about, this is what we've done. We take a food that they're designed to eat, put it in our modern way of doing things to process it, make it so that the first part of their digestive tract can't operate on it, right? It can't, you cannot ferment already cooked sliced pan. So we take it, do all of our thing to it in a very poor way, put it in, and we take out the germ, we don't do the bacterial fermentation, then put it into the duck, and they're getting malnourished. That's exactly what we're doing to ourselves.
So actually, that reminds me, I believe cattle or cows, if you feed them too much grains, it can give them metabolic problems and metabolic issues. So a similar kind of thing, if we process material, if we change the food, and if we give an animal something it wasn't really designed for, or any or all of those things, we can cause metabolic problems. And guess what we've got in the world today? Enormous epidemic of metabolic disease.
Absolutely. And what we're talking about is happening in everywhere we turn. Every time we turn around, what we think is real food isn't food anymore, and it's been processed the wrong way. So the bread example is one. Another example is maize. So it's a long example, so I'll give you the short version, but maize was first domesticated 15,000 years ago in the Balsas Valley of Mexico. And entire civilizations were built around maize. I mean, and it wasn't like they ate a little bit of maize and a bunch of other stuff. They ate maize and a little bit of other stuff. I mean, huge amounts of maize. And when the early European explorers come to the New World, they liked the maize. They liked it. They, you know, they tasted good. It was filling. It was easy to grow. It was cheap. And they brought maize back to Europe. And not long after, in its wake, as it spread through Europe, was a disease called pellagra, where over the past 300-400 years, millions of people around the world have gotten sick and hundreds of thousands have died. And to me, this is the poster child example of lack of food processing the proper way. And, you know, so maize is one of the most difficult grains for the human body to fully digest and to get all the nutrition from. You know, and the great example I always give, and I know I'm in Ireland where you guys don't eat as much corn as we do, but we eat lots of corn in America, and a lot of times we eat a corn on the cob, and everybody that's eating corn on the cob has seen corn the next day, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a good example, right, of it not being that digestible. But even when it's ground up, it doesn't matter. It's very difficult for our body to derive all the nutrition from it. So what happens is, as soon as it hits Europe, we start seeing accounts in the 1700s and then later through time of this disease called pellagra, which first in Spain we see it, then we see it in Italy, and then in Eastern Europe. And it starts off as red, rashy skin and these scabs that look like leprosy. Your things are falling off and your mouth is bleeding. You go blind and eventually die. And so I think pellagra in Italian is sour skin or something is where the word comes from. And so this is happening for hundreds of years. It shows up in Ireland at the end of the Irish potato famine, where when the U.S. shipped a bunch of cornmeal over as famine relief food, and people who had access to it were eating massive amounts of it, and all of a sudden this disease pops up in Ireland. And then one of the worst cases was actually in America in the early 20th century. Literally hundreds of thousands of people died in America, millions got sick in the early 1900s in the American Southeast, where they're eating massive amounts of corn. And they hired an infectious disease doctor by the name of Jeffrey Goldberger to come in to study this and find out what the problem was. And he's studying, he can't really figure it out. And he looks at some of these accounts of this pellagra, and he sees it has an association with corn. He comes back, he says, listen, I don't know what this is. I can tell you it's not infectious. I think it's diet related, and I think it has to do with corn. And they were like, first off, nothing this bad is diet related, which is an obvious answer, right? Secondly, don't mess with our corn. Like, corn is king in the South. Mm-hmm. So he ended up taking groups of people in insane asylums or mental institutions, and prisons, and he divided them in half and fed half nothing but corn and the other half regular diets, and these people with the corn were presenting with it. So they still didn't believe him. So he and his wife and his partner would hold these public demonstrations where they'd gather people around, and he'd take some of these people that were, you know, skin was falling off of them, and they'd draw blood from them and put them in their own veins. He'd swab them with cotton swabs on their mucous membrane, swab themselves, and then they'd actually eat the scabs off of them. Well, he'd put them in pills and swallow it.
Delicious.
Just to show that it wasn't infectious. This was 1917. Mm-hmm. And finally, we believed them, but still didn't know what the association was. But it wasn't until 1938 when there were a couple scientists studying a disease that was popping up in dogs in the Midwest. They had this disease called black tongue that they were eating, who were eating massive amounts of corn as the mainstay of these dogs' diet. They realized that if they fed them liver, then it would go away. And then later they defined it down to niacin. So you know what? It's niacin. So they started fortifying all baked goods with niacin. So anywhere, and I know it's in Ireland as well, most baked goods are fortified with niacin. Mm. And this is why. Well, here's the issue. 15,000 years, maize has been the mainstay in the diet, and there's no evidence of pellagra at all in the Americas until it comes back in the 20th century. Mm. But all of a sudden, as soon as maize is taken out of the Americas, everybody's getting sick and dying from it. Well, the reason is because in the past, people were doing a process called nishtamalization. They would take the maize. So the people that grew up around, the people that domesticated maize and built their entire culture around it, realized that if they took the corn and simmered it in an alkaline solution, so they would use wood ash, for 20 minutes, then let it sit overnight, and then grind it up, all the nutrients in the corn would be accessible to the human body. All of them. One of those nutrients is niacin. Mm. So, this is how weak we are as a species, our digestive tract. Millions of people around the world over the past few hundred years and hundreds of thousands died because of a nutrient deficiency while eating nothing but the food that actually had it in it. It all went directly through their digestive tract. So, here we are with maize, and it's the past 2 years is the most widely grown grain in the world, and only a small fraction of it is still being processed the right way. Only real traditional tortillas, real traditional tamales are processed the right way. I don't care if you are grinding it or baking it or steaming it or eating whatever. It doesn't matter. A lot of that, some of that nutrition is passing right through your body.
Hey guys, just a quick reminder that I do need to be supported to provide all of this content, and you can do so at patreon.com/IvarCummins or for a one-off or monthly at PayPal, and you can get that at tinyurl.com/IvarCummins. So hopefully you can help me to continue to provide good, correct scientific interpretation and counter somewhat the biased corporate version of science. Thank you, guys.
And it shows you the instinctive ingenuity of humans, though, that they find something like that, they probably sense the challenges with it, and they somehow find the way to fix the problem. But the modern way is to simply dump in niacin. Yeah. So all the
grains,
That's a Band-Aid. So all of the grains now are fortified with iron, fortified with this, fortified with niacin, obviously. So we take foods, we don't process them properly to make them less problematic and more useful. We just kind of just dump in. We have the technology now, essentially, to just dump in what causes the most obvious problem and make it go away.
Right, but it doesn't. And pellagra is still an issue in places, in parts of Africa, mm-hmm. where maize has come in. There's still, maize is, brought in there for... It's the only food some people are eating, and they're suffering from the same issues. Yeah.
And if we distill it down, I know you're familiar with Weston Price Absolutely. And his incredible work in the 1920s, but he actually summarized our challenges with food down to its most simplest. And he basically fingered sugars, refined grains, and vegetable oils. And I only found out last year, I used to make the point, well, look, I know the vegetable fats are a problem mechanistically. We don't really have the human trials, but animal models show that omega-6 fats too much, it's a problem. But we don't have proof. So what caused the major outbreak in the last 50, 60 years of metabolic disease, heart disease, all the rest? And I said, well, look, carbohydrates refined and sugars, they were there back in Weston Price's time when he saw the cousins of a tribe who went to the city, their health collapsed, but they didn't have vegetable oils. And then a friend, Tucker Goodrich, actually showed me in Weston Price's book, he puts vegetable fats as the third element. So he has it written in the book. And of course, they were shipping over large amounts of those vegetable fats then. So the answer for me is sugar, refined carb, vegetable fats, all bad processing. It's hard to pick out which is the worst. But if you avoid all three, in which case you have to avoid modern processed food because they're stuffed
by default.
That.
Yeah.
If you knock out those three, you're probably 80% there.
I agree. And if you pay attention to all the other foods that you're eating, how they're being made, the difference between a raw fermented dairy product and ultra pasteurized milk, skim milk, are two completely different foods. We might call them both dairy, we might call them both, one has no, just in my mind, just as much as vegetable oils have no business going in the human body, the ultra pasteurized homogenized skim milk has no business going in the human body either. But the other I can make a strong argument that raw fermented dairy can be an incredible, you know, way to introduce good nutrients in a modern human diet.
Yeah, because in principle, it comes from, it is inherently animal, and that's how we evolved. So it's unlikely to be a problem. I have heard, though, we focus as well on APOE4 type genotype. I think Stephen Gundry has talked a lot about this, that specifically in humans who have developed metabolic disease, which may make them different now and sensitive, that dairy or excessive saturated fats raises inflammatory markers in some. So it's something for APOE4 people would say a high calcium score to be a little bit careful. However, I also wonder, is it more the dairy and possibly the casein A1, the modern type protein? Now, no one's picked it apart, but it's an interesting one. Are some of the modern strains, and perhaps related to the modern processing of dairy as well, not being raw, unprocessed, is that where some of this inflammatory signal comes from? But it's speculative now. It's something to keep looking at, I think.
It is. And you know, that A1, A2 debate is raging in the U.S. right now. A lot of people are jumping on the A2 bandwagon. And I think there's some validity to it, except when we focus on one thing, we forget other things that could be huge. So again, a pasteurized, homogenized A2 milk is a completely different food than raw fermented A2 milk, right?
Yeah, and that's, no one has really done the work to tease them apart, because, well, one reason is that really annoys me. They wasted 30 or 40 years going after cholesterol and fat, and that's where the billions of dollars went. The irony is, Bill, would you believe they actually spent enormous resources studying real foods to see if they could cause a problem, and didn't spend any money on the processed foods, checking those out. But that's industry, I guess. So real foods, yeah, eating real food and processed in a ancestral way. And that's a pretty broad definition. Ancestral means 10 or 20,000 years ago and before. Processing that ties in with cultures and tribes that it was used for thousands of years, this processing. Then it's in a good processing.
Yeah.
And recent processing in the last 100 years is quite frankly terrible, because it's just economically driven in a modern mass technology society. So it seems that all the processing nowadays that is driven by the profit motive, it always ends up being bad processing. It's funny, isn't it? It's almost like that's the rule or that's the law. It's very unlikely that something's going to be cheap as hell to buy, cheap as hell to make, and make a big profit. It's going to happen to be something that's really good. It just doesn't happen.
No, absolutely. And I think, but I do want to say, I don't think the ideal human diet has been created yet. First off, I think it's very contextual too. I it has to change as we change, because an ideal diet has to, again, both meet and exceed our biological and cultural needs and expectations. And the cultural piece is continuously changing, you know, certainly all the time. But you know, a lot of the stuff in the past, trial and error, some of it worked great, some of it didn't work at all, and those people died off. Some of it was working good enough, right? And it just, again, just because it was in the past doesn't mean it was excellent. Probably means it's better than now, but I also don't want to suggest that there isn't anything new we can find out. At the same time.
Fair point.
Certainly.
Yeah, and I mean, some of the things discovered were really cool, like fermentation to make alcohol.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And fermentation is the huge one. Anybody just starting out, fermentation, I have never seen a traditional or indigenous group around the world, and I've worked with a lot of them, where the basis of every one of their diets has something to do with fermentation, and usually many different types of fermentations.
And actually, remind me, Bill, I saw a fantastic documentary on an American Airlines flight, and it was somewhere in the East, and they had huge markets with fermented sauerkraut-type vegetables, and they had ones that were there 10 years old in jars, they were really expensive, almost like wines, and this enormous market with all these different vendors, and they're all selling fermented vegetables. And the whole culture revolved around them. And they would be really good, right, for many reasons.
Oh,
microbiome and all the stuff. Fiber is still in them. Everything
is completely alive. It's quite often, fermentation is one of the best ways to detoxify certain toxins and vegetables. It's somewhat pre-digested, so it's easier for your body to access the nutrients. It doesn't have to work as hard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it releases certain nutrients you didn't already have access to. And it also, in some cases, some of the nutrients get stronger or multiply during the fermentation process. So it, you know, we take these foods and freeze them or dry them or cook them or do something to them, and a lot of times we'll reduce the nutrients in them for storage. This actually enhances them, yeah.
Yeah, and if you take like the health benefits of natto, vitamin K2, that's a fermentation from bacteria,
yeah.
And that's going to maybe be really big in the next 10 years. But that's yet another example of fermentation. And the bacteria that grow and all in these fermented products and what they produce, it's nearly always a net positive.
Absolutely.
In a general sense. So I often think if someone had, say, because I obviously work in heart disease, extensive heart disease, calcification, what's the safest diet? And I would tend to say fish, eggs, avocado, fermented vegetables, mm-hmm. for all those nutrients. Maybe be a little careful going overly rich on your food. And of course, fasting and spreading meals to keep your insulin low and pulsatile. So it's not too hard to think of the ideal diet. But there is this current thing, let's say, with vegan on one end, and amazingly, there's a carnivore type tribe emerging on the other. Now, you're right in the middle.
I'm right in the middle.
Ancestral, yeah. Culturally appropriate. But these polarized debates, I mean, what do you think about vegetarian, especially fish, flexitarian, or with eggs, ovo, lacto, that's all going to be really possible to have healthy. But vegan is quite unusual. Is there any historical ancestral precedent for actually vegan?
There's no evidence for, it'd be hard to identify anyhow, but people have been looking. There is no evidence for any vegan society prehistorically. None. Yeah. On the other hand, and again, I don't want to get into a vegan carnivore debate, but there are, although this can help with some of that, there are groups that have subsisted almost entirely on animals, but because of where they happen to live, not necessarily always by choice, more by design, right? But those people are not eating meat; they're eating the entire animal, and that's so. For example, the Sami, there's a great article several years ago that came out about Neanderthals. And they looked at the dental calculus on Neanderthal teeth, and I forget the date. They were like 35,000 years old, and they saw on the teeth phytoliths, which are little microscopic plant stones, for little silica bodies. And the cool thing about phytoliths for an archaeologist is that they are specific to individual types of plants. So if you find one, you can say, hey, this came from either this plant or this family of plants, which is cool. And the other thing is they're made out of silica. So while the rest of the plant has rotted away long ago, this is like a little stone that doesn't rot away. And the other really cool thing about them is under a microscope, they have a little tiny organic piece on the very inside protected by silica. So if you find enough of them, you can actually carbon-14 date them, which is really cool. So it's a win-win across the board. But they find these Neanderthal teeth. And they get the dental calculus, you know, just the junk on the teeth off of them. And they look at the phytoliths from these plants and they realize these are plants that they have no business eating. There's actually no reason they should be eating these plants. There's no nutrition that our human digestive tract can get out of them. And they can't even fathom a way to process these plants to get them. So the original interpretation was that they must have been using them for some kind of medicine. But there was just too much of them there. I mean, that was a lot of medicine, right, to do it. So, you know, the later interpretation, which I think is fantastic, was they came from somewhere else. Now, one of the most powerful technologies we ever developed to take a resource that our body has no business accessing and turn it into nutrition we can access is actually animals.
Ah, you can, I've heard it said once that you can take these, you know, nutrient poor, inappropriate grains and pass them through a cow and make high protein, ultra nutrient dense meats.
Yeah. So animals, and the way we've treated animals in the past, and when we still do with wild animals, we take these animals and use them as a factory, not to be crude, but I mean, use them as a factory to take food we can't derive nutrition from and turn it into something that we can.
Especially grasses, all these huge grasslands around the earth that are useless for other purposes. They can be amazing for the process you described.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the Sami in northern Finland, you know, in northern Scandinavia do this with, you know, their reindeer herders, semi-domesticated reindeer. These reindeer eat lichen off of rocks and turn it into milk and blood. But here's the cool thing, if you think about, if that's the model you're looking at, and it's a hard one for us to fathom now, because now we feed animals people food and then try to figure out the whole, but we're talking about wild animals, wild wild resources, and transforming them into blood, fat, you know, milk, whatever, meat. Every time it does that, there's a loss, right? So this animal's eating something, there's a loss in energy, there's a loss in nutrition by the time it makes it into the blood or the fat or whatever, but it's still a great system, but it's, there's still a little bit of a loss. The best place to access the nutrients is after the animal's broken it down, but before it's absorbed the nutrients.
In the stomach.
It's called chyme. So in the stomach and in the small, just the upper part of the small intestines. So, which is still done. The Sami still do it. We have a lot of ethnographic accounts around the world of early explorers seeing people doing this. Inuits would do it. And that's what we think the Neanderthals are doing, because in the chyme, those phytoliths still exist. So if they're eating the contents of the stomach and getting it on their teeth, here they are with, you know, phytoliths from lichen or whatever on their teeth, and they've derived incredible nutrition.
And Neanderthals as well. Well, they were pretty smart compared to the apes. I mean, they were close.
Oh, their brains are bigger than ours.
Bigger, but they wouldn't really be smarter.
Nah, not necessarily.
We all still, actually, I did 23andMe, we have 3% or 2% Neanderthal genes still. Yep. So yeah, they were very, very close. I saw a theory once that the reason the humans won and won out is they developed fishing. And then all the EPA, DHA, and all the fish benefits gave them some of their thing. But again, highly speculative. So these Neanderthals, they were eating nose to tail. I mean, no question.
Fully. Yeah, absolutely.
And they was it the Neanderthals or the Homo sapiens that would have really eradicated the megafauna because there were such hunters? Or
it was mostly the. It depends on where you are in the world, because. Yeah. But it, for most of the megafauna extinction, it was Homo sapiens. It was most of that's 12,000-14,000 years ago. So it's just us.
Yeah, and the Neanderthals were what, around 30,000? They faded out, or
yeah, some might have lasted around 25,000-26,000, but that was the most recent. Yeah. But if you think about these arguments about ethics, sustainability, nutrition, and you know, most of the animals in the U.S., the numbers are 55% of a pig and 50% of a cow by weight end up in our grocery stores. Mm-hmm. So, okay. The half of that we're not eating represents more than half the nutrition that animal has to offer. We've done a bunch of studies in here, and we did a bunch of studies recently, about 10 years ago, with white-tailed deer. But amazing. For an average-sized white-tailed deer, what we did was we took 13 deer, and we weighed them and took them completely apart and took all that percentage that would end up, that most hunters would keep, would the same percentage that would end up in the grocery store. We put it aside. And I mean, we ate it and stuff, but we put it aside for the calculations. We took all the rest of it. We took every bit of marrow out of every finger. We took all the fat, all of it, and looked at calories just because it was easy. One average-sized white-tailed deer, the part that is usually discarded would provide, depending on your caloric needs, right? Depending, if couch rotated to an athlete, we took 13 to 31 days worth of calories. That's the part we get rid of.
And it's the more nutrient dense
yes.
part, because you're including all the organ meats there and the marrows and
it's brain. Not only nutrient dense, it's more nutrient accessible as well. You don't even have to cook those parts to get all the nutrients out of them. So when you know, to think about it, you know, I've been hunting since I was 8 years old. Never ever did I find any pleasure in killing an animal. I find incredible pleasure and reward and everything that happens afterwards. In fact, everything that leads up to it too, you know, hunting with my son and when I used to hunt with my dad, that's all a ton of pleasure. And then there's the moment that an animal is killed, which there's no pleasure in this. I do feel a responsibility to do it, but everything after, you know, we eat fully nose to tail in our house. I mean, we do all our own butchering of anything we've killed. We do a lot of butchering and things that we get from local farmers. But, you know, it's almost like a challenge. What can I do with all this? And, you know, how much can I get out of it? And that, you know, think about the equation. Without doing anything else but changing our mindset, which I know is hard to do, but by tomorrow, we can more than double the amount of nutrition, and it's a better nutrition that comes out of the animals we already have.
Or put in another way, you can have the environmental impact, and I know that's another whole argument about animals and environmental impact. You can have the environmental impact by doing that overnight.
Yeah. half it.
It's kind of insane. I never thought of it quite like that. You'll be probably a little bit proud of me, Bill. I'm going to tell you something now. The Public Health Collaboration, phcuk.org.
Okay.
Sam Feltham, Asim Malhotra, and basically a real food organization in the UK. They had Organuary. So, you know, Veganuary,
yeah,
for Vegan January, they had Organuary.
Very nice.
I did my bit. I put some stuff on Instagram on the fly, but I made a terrine because I'm not crazy about the taste of liver,
yeah,
but I've always loved the French terrine. And it was around 300 or 400 grams of liver, chicken liver, around 500-600 grams of pork, fatty pork. And then you put in pistachios and all, and you cook it with water in the pan. And then you crush it as it cools.
Put a weight on it, yeah.
Put a weight. Oh, it's so good. And you'd never think you're eating liver.
Yeah.
I mean, not the liver's bad, but you'd never realize you're eating something that's around 25% liver.
That's fantastic.
So terrine, I think, is my way to organ meats.
Especially with chicken liver, so accessible. Because it's not a strong flavor compared to, say, beef liver or something.
I made a second one last week with pork liver, and it was a little stronger, all right. But
yeah,
still not as strong as beef, I think.
Yeah.
So I know we have to wrap up now at some point, but any last thoughts then? I think we really know what the proper diet is. It's a diet of real foods without negative modern processing, but by all means, including culturally proven ancestral processing that was part of our journey here as a human species.
Mm-hmm.
Is that one way, or what way will you wrap it up?
Absolutely. So mm-hmm. I would say, again, back to this how we eat, not necessarily what we eat. You know, I saw a thing the other day that said, you know, if we broke into a day, you know, if 24 hours was the time we've been, you know, on this planet, that we've been hunter-gatherers for this long, farmers for this long, and I forget all the numbers, and, you know, we've been hunter-gatherers forever. But the funny part, I thought, was most interesting part was we've been calorie counters for 30 seconds. You know, we instinctually, and here's the issue, we instinctually have in our bodies, I fully believe this, what we need to understand when we're full, when something's nourishing to us. If we're in tune with our food and if we're in tune with our bodies, we can trust those signals. Because all animals have them, and we're a heck of a lot smarter, but other animals aren't obese. Other animals, the only other animals that are having the same sort of issues as our pets, because we're feeding them
our food.
But they don't have nutritionists. They don't have they don't have any of this. They can do it that themselves. The difference with humans is that we do need some sort of assistance, because, you know, some sort of help from somebody else, because we have to know how to process the food. It's not that we decide what we should put into our mouth, even though that's what everybody's focusing on. That to me isn't an issue if food is real. If you have real food in front of you, we should be able to stop ourselves from eating when we're satiated, because our food is satiating. We should feel nourished. We should feel good. We should know what that feels like. That's not the issue, even though that's what everybody's focusing on. It's how. And that's what we need help with. That's what mothers and fathers and grandparents and chiefs and everybody else used to teach us for millennia, right? We need to know how to take a resource and turn it into something that is good for our bodies. Because that's the difference between us and other animals. We don't have that on the inside. We have to do it on the outside. So this is my suggestion for everyone. And I know this may sound insane for a minute, but just bear with me. The two things that I think are the most important is connection to our food, and understanding the how, not the what. So the connection comes with everybody. I want everybody to take one step closer to the source of their food. You know, if they're buying chicken breast at the grocery store, they should buy a whole chicken. If they're buying whole chicken at the grocery store, they should go to the farmer. They should meet the farmer. If they're already doing that, maybe go out on, I was out snipe hunting up in Cavan on Saturday. It was fantastic. Maybe try to get out in the field, or even go to forage, take a foraging class and try to forage. I gave a foraging class to Google 2 years ago in Dublin. We foraged right through the middle of Dublin, and it was fantastic. So, you know, do this connection piece is fantastic. It's wonderful. It's empowering. But the next part is the how. I fully believe if we're going to make a difference in our own diets, in the diets of our families, diets of our communities, it's not going to be, you know, changing one meal a week. It's going to be changing the things we eat every single day. Our bread, our snacks, our cheese, whatever it is that we eat most of, that's what we should focus on first. So what I tell everyone, take those foods that you eat all the time and make them from scratch 100%. Like, even if you only do it one time, make it fully from, and even if it's not even edible, you've empowered yourself to then walk into a grocery store and see through all the marketing, all the advertising, you're ripping down the veil, and you can at least buy and purchase the food that's been processed the right way for your family. And the other cool part is you're voting with your checkbook. You know, you're putting money behind the people that are doing it right. Mm-hmm. And that's how we're going to change the food system. But that's that empowerment piece, I think, is the most important.
Excellent. Well, thanks a lot, Bill.
And Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. Good luck.
Thanks for listening, guys, and hopefully you enjoyed it. And just a reminder that I do need support to continue putting together all of this content. And at patreon.com/IvorCummins or for PayPal at tinyurl.com/IvorCummins, where you can do a one-off or a monthly support. So I'd really appreciate that, guys, and keep me getting the science out there and countering perhaps the more biased corporate type science. Thank you.